On April 12, 1861, Fort Sumter was fired upon by the Confederate troops. This event catapulted the U.S. into a war pitting brother against brother. Iron ore was needed for steel to produce war machinery. This need had a direct impact on the development of the Wilderness area in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. As the Civil War ended, the United States saw the beginning of industrial growth. By the 1890s, the U.S. had become the world's largest producer of steel. This industrialization brought the need for a larger workforce. The demand was fulfilled by the rising rate of immigration. Immigrants found jobs throughout the United States. The discovery of iron ore Marquette County, located in Michigan's Upper Peninsula by federal surveyors, had attracted the attention of mining promoters throughout the country. Many small communities and hamlets emerged around the mining operations, which began to develop. Marquette County experienced phenomenal growth from 2,821 residents in 1860 to 46,076 residents in 1910. With the advent of the assembly line of production, as well as the United States' involvement in World War I, the need for iron ore and steel increased. To meet this need, an iron ore procurement committee was organized by President Wilson in an effort to produce as much ore as possible. Drilling for ore bodies increased on the Marquette Range. Several mining companies, including Cleveland Cliffs Iron Company, were engaged in mining operations in the central portion of the Upper Peninsula. Ore deposits were found throughout this area, and the decision to mine was made. Two mines were opened in the North Lake District, the Lloyd Mine and the Morris Mine. Further explorations discovered another body of ore approximately 1.5 miles west of the Morris Mine. This mining operation was called the Barnes Hecker, which had an adjacent residential locality bearing the same name. The decision to open the Barnes Hecker mine was made on July 30, 1917. By 1918, all mine buildings were completed and 10 duplex houses were occupied. By 1919, all three levels of the Barnes Hecker were completed. An excess amount of water was encountered on all three levels of the Barnes Hecker. In fact, the problem of water was so severe on the second level that the company was forced to discontinue operations until adequate measures were taken. At one point, pumps were eliminating as much as 1,100 gallons of water per minute from the mine. Despite problems, by 1925, production had reached 138,582 tons. The 1926 workforce totaled 127 people, with 21 families residing in the Barnes Hecker location. As production continued, some miners at the Barnes Hecker began hearing water gurgling behind those cold walls of stone. Wednesday, November 3rd, 1926, began as a routine day at the Barnes Hecker mine. Customers would have ample time to settle during the lunch break. Mr. Wilford Wills, a motorman on the second level, and his brakeman, Jack Hanna, had just dumped a load of ore in a pocket near the mouth of the drift and were on their way back to get another load. They were 200 feet inside the drift when they heard a violent gush of air howl past them, blowing out their helmet-mounted carbide lamps. At the same time, they heard an awful thundering noise inside the mine. The two sensed something was terribly wrong and that stopping to find out what might be fatal. The electric lights along the train track dimmed, flickered, and finally died. A feeling of terror gripped their bodies as they realized their situation. The men were enveloped in total darkness. They had to kick the rail track to guide them as they groped their way to the shaft. Reaching the shaft, they realized that the electrically operated cage elevator was also out of commission. Their only means of escape was the emergency ladder, which ran up the shaft. Joe Mankey, the second level skip tender, joined the men at the shaft. They started frantically climbing in order to elude death. Mr. Wills, a strong, lean young man, climbed more swiftly than his two partners. Climbing 200 feet, he reached the first level ahead of the other two men. Here he met Tom Kirby, the first level skip operator. Frantically, Wills alerted Kirby of the impending doom. Again, Wills grabbed the ladder and took the lead. There were now four men climbing. As they continued, the water and debris rushed up at them, threatening to tear them from the ladder. Wills felt the ladder shake violently and heard his companions yell. Never looking down, he knew he was alone and that the ladder had fractured beneath him. Water lapped at his boots. Wilford Wills began his race against death. Using his teeth to tear off his gloves, Wills aided his ability to retain a firm grip on the ladder. Beyond human comprehension, Wills pushed himself, propelling his legs in a continual pumping motion, fixing his gaze on the ever-widening speck of light at the top of the shaft. A human face appeared in the lighted opening, beckoning and encouraging Wills. It was his half-brother Albert Tippett who grabbed him by his jacket and pulled him out of the shaft. In only 10 minutes, Will had climbed 800 feet, nearly the height of the Eiffel Tower. The race ended, and the victor collapsed in exhaustion. News of the cave-in reached the Morris mine in minutes. Fearing for the safety of the men in this mine, Mr. Charles Stakel, superintendent of the mines, rushed underground to the sixth level of the Morris to inspect the tunnel connecting it to the third level of the Barnes Hecker. It was here that he and several other workers discovered the bodies of seven men who apparently tried to flee through the only other escape route available to them. Mr. Stakel also discovered that the raise connecting the two levels was plugged with enough debris and timber to resist the water pressure from the Barnes Hecker. This temporary plug saved the Morris mine from flooding. The Barnes Hecker cave-in became Michigan's worst mine disaster. News of the tragedy traveled like an electric shock throughout the community. Children of the victims were sent home.
My sister and I were attending school at the Greenwood School, and about 1 o'clock that day, a neighbor, a Mrs. Valenti, came in and told our teacher, Andrea Johnson, something had happened at the Barnes Hecker. She wasn't quite sure what it was, so the teacher dismissed us. I didn't think much of it until I got off the bus and see the people watching us.
Few families remained untouched by the tragedy. Some families lost more than one member.
Her older brother, Bill, was trapped in a mine at this time. And her younger brother, Walter, who put his first shift in a mine that day, he was also trapped in a mine at this time. Her other brother, Albert, he just came to surface just prior to the disaster. And her other brother, which was a half-brother, climbed to surface and was a sole survivor.
Mrs. Wilford Wills had joy in her husband's heroic escape, but sorrow in the loss of her father, Sam Phillippe. Joe Mankey, who lost his life in the frantic climb on the shaft ladder, had been the best man at the wedding of Wilford Wills. The entire community was engulfed in grief. Widows found comfort in their children, in whom the father's spirit still lived. Of the bodies rescued, the first funeral was held for Mr. William Hill, the mine inspector.
The funeral was held 2 days later at Bethel Lutheran Church, but the body was at our home, and a lot of people came there, friends and strangers, neighbors.
Several thousand persons filled three local churches to pay tribute to the deceased. No amount of money or sympathy could replace the loss of human life, but the miner's employer, Cleveland Cliffs Iron Company, provided the families with double compensation, free rent of company houses, free electricity and water, as well as the promise of employment.
The company promised my mother that all the boys would get a job when they become age to work.
Rescue attempts to claim the 41 bodies continued.
And there was a real sad sight to see them all crying, and my mother cried steady all the way over there. And I seen the skips of the mine just bailing this water out.
Mining officials found attempts to reclaim the bodies too risky because of the continuous flooding of the mine. After 2.5 months of such efforts, an official announced, "The mine is a cemetery from which no remains can be taken in recognizable form, and of which long before they could be reached, there would be no trace, being absorbed by the earth from which they came. The shaft at the Barnes Hecker was sealed and the area surrounded by a fence. All that remained was a large pond of water filling the hole, which was left by the cave-in. In tribute to those miners who lost their lives, a 6-foot granite monument was erected. A grieving relative, mourning her loss, was counseled by her mother.
My dear, the whole world can't stop because of our sorrow."
The Market Range mining industry did not stop with this tragedy, but has triumphed and remained as the lifeblood of our area. Today, Cleveland Cliffs Iron Company employs nearly 3,000 people, many of which are sons and grandsons of the Barnes Hecker victims. In 1984, 13 million tons of iron ore pellets were shipped to steel producing centers throughout the United States. The Market Range is indeed a vital and needed resource for our nation's industries.